Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you from the Nexus at Expo City, Dubai. I'm Tom Edwards. This is the second in our series of special editions of the programme, in which we're going to be training Monocle's lens on some of the critical themes emerging from the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Today, in our latest broadcast, we welcome some very special guests to help us explore heat, well-being and the city. We'll meet Bushra Afrian, Chief Heat Officer for North Dhaka, Bangladesh, Asia's first such appointment. She's a woman that's helping to meet people where they are to build resilience in the face of climate impact. We'll also meet Antonia Carver, Director of Art Jameel and one of the innovators behind its sustainability pavilion created for COP28. She'll share insights gleaned from projects exploring sustainability in materials and purpose. Not only that, but we'll take a little detour to hear from a local entrepreneur who's addressing the climate threat and the need for real sustainability and innovation in food from provenance to supply chain.
Seafood is unique because it's the only food source, really, that we still extract from the ocean, hoping to come back next year for more. Everything else we farm, 50% of seafood we farm today, the remaining 50% is still wild caught.
Find out how that innovator is moving the needle a little later in the programme. All that to look forward to on this special edition of The Briefing from the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. A warm welcome to the programme. We're kicking off the show with another terrific panel for you, featuring, once again, Monocle's Editor-in-Chief Andrew Tuck. Alongside him, we welcome Bushra Afrian, Chief Heat Officer, North Dhaka, Bangladesh, and also Antonia Carver, Director of Art Jameel, and a woman with some fascinating insights gleaned from projects exploring sustainability and some compelling work based around the effects of heat and humidity. I kicked off the session by asking Bushra about the immediacy of the situation she's dealing with on the ground and to provide some critical context to her work there.
Dhaka North, where I work, is home to 15 million people and growing every day because we have 2,000 people coming into the city every single day to work, and a lot of them, most of them, are climate migrants, so people who've been displaced by climate change. And we understandably have a huge informal sector, so that includes informal settlements. There was a recent study done by the UNDP and the BUET organization, and they found that almost 900,000 people lived in informal settlements, 50% whom are women. And that really, I feel like, is critical to understanding the risks, especially with when it comes to heat, what we are really facing and who are the most vulnerable. And the immediacy and the urgency that I would like to convey is that heat doesn't affect everybody equally. We all feel it, but we have different access and privileges that allows us to seek solutions and cooling solutions particularly. But on a hot day, a lot of us in this room today are privileged to be able to escape from heat, but the people that I'm talking about, they can't escape from it. There's no respite, which makes you severely vulnerable.
Bushra, can I just jump in? Just again for the context, just tell people a little bit about that weather. So how hot does it get in summer, and how impactful can the rains be?
So last year we had the hottest year on record, but that was the case for a lot of cities and countries around the world, right? It was globally the hottest year ever in human history. But it was interesting because we had it during Ramadan. A lot of people were fasting. And due to religious or cultural reasons, when people felt sick, even though religiously it's allowed to break your fast, a lot of people didn't and got really sick and even had fatal consequences for a lot of people as well. Temperatures went up to 42 degrees. It felt like more because of the humidity. The heat index actually was very high. When you have heat and humidity together and with air pollution, that makes it significantly worse. Everybody has asthma or respiratory diseases, including me. Like, I never had asthma growing up, and now I have to carry around two inhalers everywhere I go. Every single person I know is going through respiratory problems back home. Every single person, without exception, including children. My daughter, who's three, every single child I know in her school is on nebulizers and respiratory medication. It's really difficult for children in particular because they cannot regulate their body temperatures. So when it gets hot like that, and it's summer or it's summer vacation, and parents don't realize that summer when we were children and summer now is vastly different. Summers when we were growing up used to be fun and mangoes and jackfruits, you know. It's still that, but a lot more dangerous to stay outside. Understanding in our context that people have grown up in a hot and humid weather, when you add that to the mix, it's a horrific reality that people think that they're used to this heat. And then at a certain temperature, you're not safe anymore, but they don't know that. They don't know that their cells will literally disintegrate. Like, it's not public knowledge. That information, even though it's out there scientifically, it is not publicly accessible or simplified or broken down for the public.
Well, and this is a super interesting idea, yeah. Which is that despite that urgency, as you said, the cold reality or hot reality is staring people in the face, it's critically important to make sure that the frames of reference are established. And I guess, Antonio, that's where, you know, the cultural realm, if we look at an institution like what Art Jamil does generally, but specifically in this space, such an important role in making that story and communicating the urgency, making that compelling. Is that, I guess that's a thread that runs through all of the work that you do there?
Yeah, totally. And thank you for having me, and amazing to listen to what Bushra is saying. Yeah, I think the arts have a kind of unique capacity in a way to convene and to communicate, right? To bring people together and to talk about the kinds of issues that you're referring to, Bushra. So we tend to, at Art Jamil, we think about everything from the kind of very, you know, public-facing mass kind of popular events such as Down to Earth, our annual sustainability festival, as a way of kind of communicating to the general public the urgency of what we're talking about today.
Well, let's talk a bit about, I mentioned in the introduction, the Sustainability Pavilion, and this is a project that embodies not just that deep research and that fascination with the local and the global, but then practicality and doing something that's provocative. Tell us a bit about that project, how it came together, and then how it manifested itself. Not too far away from here.
Not too far away from here. Since we're on radio, I guess I'll just give a very brief kind of description of what it looks like, but I urge everyone to come down and see it. So at Jamil Arts Centre in Jadaf Waterfront here in Dubai, we commissioned an architectural pavilion from the architect who goes under the name of The Other Dada. And Adib is a regenerative architect, and Tarabat weaving a pavilion is an incredible kind of large-scale architectural pavilion. It's a kind of dome that's a lattice of a kind of untreated steel that's in a particular shape that coral love. So when the pavilion actually comes down, it's going to be sunk in the sea off Fujairah. We're working with conservationists there, and it will become a mass coral-growing site. And then this structure is filled with these different cones, which are all created from new types of organic building materials that are all developed by eco startups here in the UAE. So Desert Board, actually one of the sponsors of this, I did not know, but I'm plugging them now, have created some of these cones. Also have cones made from the pits that are in the middle of dates. So date form is a new kind of building material, through to mycelium, which is made from mushrooms. We work with the Waste Lab, which is the UAE's composting organization. They actually composted everything from the COP28 site here as well. And we work with local artists as well. Solimar Miller is a fantastic artist who specifically has a practice looking at endangered species. And all of these cones will be given back to the environment and go back out into people's gardens.
No, it's super interesting. And I think one thing that, again, is a theme that's run through a lot of these discussions, is the availability or the proximity of fixes, not total solutions, but things that can address the problems. It's a narrative we've come back to, and I love the fact that the pavilion highlights so many of those which are at the cutting edge of innovation, or they're about the artists. Is that something that informs, I guess, the approach of Art Jamil generally, is to shine that light and to make sure we're surfacing that talent, because it's right there, right? It's just not always in plain sight.
Exactly. So these are all very new kinds of startups. I mean, the aim of the pavilion is to get people down there to see how we can actually get these then taken up by the architecture and construction industry, which after all, you know, contributes 40% of greenhouse gases globally. So it's a, you know, an industry that absolutely needs to sort of innovate and to look to new kinds of solutions. And at the same time, the pavilion acts as a site. You know, we do music concerts there. We do talks, we do convenings, we're doing a series of iftars during Ramadan. So you're actually in the structure itself, which becomes a kind of talking point. And then alongside that, we obviously do a lot of different exhibitions that look at these kinds of themes of sustainability. Our last one, for example, An Ocean in Every Drop, looked at a kind of watery world. There were quite a few artists there from Bangladesh looking at those kinds of themes as well. So really across the board, sort of thinking about sustainability as a horizontal that runs through absolutely everything we do.
But sure, I wanted to bring you back in here. When we start to look at solutions, I think that many of us can feel the problems are so big that we don't know where to begin. When you were in North Dhaka, how did you begin to think, okay, I can't fix all of this, but there are steps I can take to mitigate some of these climate risks? Give us, maybe tell us about a project that you've done and that you've worked on that begins to show the kind of way ahead, maybe, for listeners.
Yes. Firstly, I'd just like to say that was amazing. I love what you've done, and it sounds fabulous. And I wish I could visit, but I am on a flight tonight. But next time.
Next time.
Next time. But yes, kind of what they did, it's the same concept of doing what you can with what you have. So at first, when I became chief read officer, I realized very quickly that the normal was, we can't do this because of blah, 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 blah. We can't do that because of blah, 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 blah. So I started asking, okay, so what can we do? What are the things that we can do with the resources that we do have? How do we get past these roadblocks and really focus on what needs to be done, and then deal with the data or deal with all those, you know, step-by-step procedures later? How do we address something that really is time sensitive? So we cannot sit around waiting for months. And I learned that in the beginning, because when I became chief heat officer, it was right in the middle of the heat wave. And the people who were most vulnerable, as I said, were people living in informal settlements, especially women living in informal settlements. And I noticed that when I talked to our urban planners about tree canopy coverage, these areas were so dense, like urban sprawls, and a lot of them had very little vegetation. The city, in the meantime, had made a commitment to plant around 200,000 trees. However, due to certain constraints, they weren't able to directly go ahead and create that green infrastructure within the informal settlements. So once I realized that, with my team, we jumped into action and we started reaching out to different organizations and saying, okay, we want to do this. Will you fund us? Will you give us the money? Will you give us the money to get fertilizers? And we figured out what their rules and regulations were. We formed partnerships with people who believed in our goal. And then we got a team together and we went out and we found a platform made up of like 76,000 women who were living in the informal settlements. And this platform was instrumental because these women were all active change makers within their communities. They were so energized and they knew what were the problems and who is related to whom and who loves trees more than the next guy and who likes, you know, mango trees, who likes jackfruit trees, who likes big canopy leafy trees, because that really played into effect what trees could we bring in to these communities that would be looked after. And together we realized and we talked about it. We really engaged with the community members and talked about heat, how it's different, how heat is not, this kind of heat wasn't normal, and what it really meant for them to take charge and reintroduce greening into their communities, take care of them, maintain them. We held workshops where we worked together on learning together how to take care of trees, because a lot of that knowledge is lost, right? As we've moved to the urban neighborhoods, we've lost the knowledge on how to garden. We've lost our green thumbs. Our grandfathers all had one.
And it's amazing how much of that story, we keep talking about empowering people, and we talk also about the absence of these catalyzing difference makers in communities, and so often empowering women does have a transformational impact on these communities. Antonio, I wanted to ask you about another really interesting project that I know Archmill was involved with, which was in collaboration with the World Weather Network, looking at exactly this, heat and humidity. And really interestingly, I gather a number of arts institutions globally, include Guyana, Lagos in Delhi, Joburg, in Dhaka, I understand, were part of this amazing network. Tell us a little bit about this one.
I'm so glad you raised that, because, you know, just picking up on what you were saying as well, Bashir, this kind of truly collaborative approach, and also the ways in which, I mean, all the research you're doing has a global kind of significance and relevance now. And we've seen that change so radically. 5 years ago, when we opened the Mill Arts Centre and said we need to think again about how to run a museum in the tropics, and we reached out to partners across Asia. We see ourselves as being in West Asia here, and we reached out across the many Asias. The response from the kind of Northern European, Northern American, sort of Western art world was like, well, this is your problem. Let us know when you've come up with something. And of course, what's happened in that very short period since then is that this is recognized as everybody's problem. Everywhere is getting hotter, you know, and the kinds of solutions and research that we're commissioning, that you're doing, the kinds of projects that we're doing have a global significance and everybody's starting to take notice. So the World Weather Network is a two-year project, began a year and a half ago. It's 28 arts organizations, as you said, all around the world. And all of us set up a weather station, but this is a weather station run by artists, writers, filmmakers, as well as ecologists and scientists. And our weather station, for example, here in Dubai at Jameel Arts Centre, is represented by these air-to-water machines, which is another local startup in Dubai, in which we harvest from the humidity in the air to create drinking water. So we've been able to go plastic-free at the centre and also dehumidify our galleries in one fell swoop, which is fantastic because artworks don't like humidity too much. And then on top of that, we've just launched a series of podcasts. So this is a kind of podcast within a podcast titled Relative Humidity. And this is commissioning artists, writers, ecologists to come up with stories and reflections on what humidity means to them. So they range from everything from a kind of sci-fi story set in 100% humidity in Abu Dhabi through to looking at what happens to traditional music instruments when they're exposed to humidity and how that can change the music itself, and then the music itself can change the way we think. So a very kind of, you know, arts-oriented approach to thinking about humidity, but in a way it's learning to live with it. You know, here in Dubai, we often, thinking of temperatures, you know, we get up to 50 degrees, we get up to very, very high humidity levels, and it's the weather we love to hate, right? We try to sort of block it out and turn up the AC. And in a way, these kinds of projects are thinking, well, we're going to have to live with this. How do we understand humidity? How do we use it as a resource? How do we rethink the ways in which we live? And one of the podcasts is all around sweat. It's okay to sweat. And, you know, so it's kind of really sort of thinking of cultural as well as ecological kind of responses to our world.
Antonia Carver, and before that, Bushra Afrian, and of course, Monocle's own Andrew Tuck. We'll be back with our panel at the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024 at Expo City Dubai in just a moment. We're changing pace and tack a little next on the programme and shifting from some of those big macro themes to hear from an innovator, an entrepreneur, who's showing how to really move the needle by challenging preconceived notions and by innovating locally, but with the intention to take those fixes to the world. Fahim Al-Kassimi is the co-founder of Seafood Souk, a business that builds tech to deliver transparency throughout the food supply chain. He joined Monocle for a chat on the margins at Expo City and began by explaining to me how his business, and a brilliant business it is, came about.
Seafood Souk was almost created a little bit by mistake. It was about 5 years ago where a friend of ours who has an oyster farm spoke about the challenges of bringing his product to market. And over that dinner, we sort of thought about how often, and I ask you listening in now, how often do you ask where your seafood comes from? And we identified a need for more transparency and traceability to build a blue economy. The reason this matters at events like today's in Sustainable Cities in Action is cities are the big consumption centers of the world, and they are the economic drivers of the world. But they are sourcing food that we eat within our cities from sometimes places quite far flung and quite far away. And while we eat a large number of things, one of the things that the world does consume as a key protein is seafood. And while you might ask your waiter where that steak came from or where your chicken might come from, very rarely do we actually ask in a restaurant, where is this piece of fish come from? And usually it's quite far removed from its original state by the time you eat it. And I'm not talking about fish fingers. I'm talking about things like a fillet or a fillet of sea bass that you may be eating. And seafood is quite unique. Seafood is unique because it's the only protein, the only food source, really, that we still extract from the ocean, hoping to come back next year for more. Mm. Everything else we farm, 50% of seafood we farm today, but the majority, or at least the remaining 50%, is still wild caught. And there, governments have tried to regulate, but IUU, illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, is still an issue. Coming back to your question, which I'm not trying to deflect, is that we as a company build technology to build transparency throughout that supply chain. Mm. Whether it starts with fishers, we've operated with Poland Line Fisheries in South Africa and built them digital logbooks to help build that traceability at the start of the supply chain. And in very innovative cities in the Emirate of Dubai, for example, we've built tools for the hospitality industry to audit the seafood that they're procuring. And we've been so fortunate to roll out some of the first seafood traceability audits for large forward-thinking hotel groups.
And what strikes me as interesting, and this is a narrative that we keep coming back to actually throughout this conference, is that often the forward-looking fixes are available locally. This might be about sourcing the materials to build and build innovatively. Or here, this mix of tapping into the story, the provenance of things, the availability of that technology locally, and the solutions are not always far flung. But this maybe taps in, if I'm to a broader kind of interest and part of your other remit that you occupy, which is that we need to marry up these big global challenges with often local fixes, because that is in itself more sustainable. Do you think there is a tendency to always look without and look from beyond borders, when actually some of these fixes are and should be available much closer to home?
I think there's two ways to answer that question. One, yes, I always recommend to any economy in the world, any city in the world, is to support that local entrepreneur first. It's a lot easier for you with the resources you have to sell to the businesses or to the consumers within your local market first. And we were very fortunate that we built these tools in this tourism center, you know, this global tourism hub that is the Emirate of Dubai. On the other hand, one of the reasons that I was quite excited about founding Seafood Souk with Sean Dennis was, I said, if we do this, can we promise to do one thing? And he said, what's that? I said, can we innovate from this region for the world and not have to look for innovation abroad? And now the projects that we have done, as I mentioned, with Poland Line Fishing in South Africa, or some traceability tools that we've built where we're having discussions in Central and South America, that excites me. That shows that we're actually building a product that has a real global fit and brings a huge amount of impact to the seafood industry and to fishing in general.
Presumably, this resource should be available everywhere, but there's always going to be those different vested interests and so forth. You're also a diplomat by training, which I presume comes in useful, but tell me how, with your entrepreneurial hat on, you navigate that complexity, because it's complex, it surely is, right?
I'll be very undiplomatic and actually be quite honest, with difficulty. I think one of the most important skill sets an entrepreneur needs to have is resilience. And some of the most successful entrepreneurs that I've learned from, I'm fortunate to call some of them my friends, the one thing is having a North Star, remaining extremely focused on the goal, and ours is impact at Seafood Souk, and sticking to it. If you get told no today, that doesn't preclude you from having that same conversation as regulation change, as the environment that you operate in changes, as people become more aware of these issues. I say this not because you've invited me, but honestly, the ability to tell this story is one step towards raising the awareness of asking for more transparency in food supply chains, requiring more provenance. I'll give you a very, very simple example. We were working, and I'll try to be diplomatically correct and not state which city, but we were speaking to a city that wanted to promote local sourcing. And they said, could we build local sourcing strategies using your traceability audits to ensure and encourage hotels and retailers to source more locally? And I refused on principle to do the project because there wasn't enough transparency on the local catch for me to be able to encourage it. And I said, if you want to do this, you need to have transparency across the entire supply chain. I cannot encourage you to overfish the body of water that you were next to as a city. So it is iterative. It is about convening. It's about discourse. It's about collaboration. One of the themes of the event today, it's about collaborating with cities, with business partners, and saying, where are your challenges and how can we build technology to make an impact?
The brilliant Fahim Al-Kassimi, co-founder of Seafood Souk, chatting to me on the margins at Expo City a little earlier. Back to our panel now, Andrew Tuck, Bushra Afrian, and Antonia Carver. Now, as part of our discussion, I asked Andrew about how Monocle looks to benchmark excellence in this space of healthy, happy, sustainable cities, long a preoccupation of ours at Monocle. We've been fortunate to speak to so many other innovators in this space, like one of Bushra's colleagues, Lenio Mirivilli, the former Chief Heat Officer of Athens, and now tasked with a global purview in the space. I asked Andrew to unpack for the audience in Dubai what some of Monocle's benchmarks look like.
Well, one of the things you mentioned Athens there, and I think that, again, we come back to this idea that actually many cities have the solutions in place. So if you go to some of the central neighborhoods, they knew that the tree canopy over meandering alleyways would provide shade, and they had tree cover. But what happened was they began to build newer districts for the city. There were sleeker apartment blocks with no shade on the street. And that simple issue of shade is so important because it allows you to be on the street. It allows people who are waiting for the bus, the rickshaw, to be in the shade. It stops, as you say, people having terrible responses to heat. So I think that when we look around the world as Monocle, you know, we recognize that these are huge issues where people are often thinking about grand visions. But whether it's in a city in Northern Europe or here in the Gulf or in South Asia, that actually, to get started, you need to think about these more incremental things that you can get going. And I think this idea of planting the trees is amazing. Can I just ask you, was it difficult to get buy-in from people? Because when people have very little, maybe, and they have a lot of priorities, saying to them, we'd like you to plant a tree and look after it, how did that part, because I think this, what Antonio's talking about, the storytelling is vital. How did that storytelling help you?
That is where the fruit trees came in, because it was a constant, it was a week of negotiations, I believe, where we were just going over back and forth with what kind of species should get in what neighborhood. And the women who were working with us on this, you know, they were able to identify that, you know, in this community, for this family, this makes sense. So we went very detailed because we knew that we had very precious resources that, you know, this is it for this year and we don't have any more. Like, we wanted all of them to survive, but we recognized also that we're going to lose some of them. And we have lost some of them. But I think what it did, however, something that is an extension of your question, is that not everyone participated in this project. Not all the informal settlements were part of it. Not all families wanted trees in their backyards or wanted us to come in and take them away from their schedules, because they also had jobs and they couldn't afford this time. But when they saw that this was a very participatory and inclusive process, even when we had the training workshops, we made sure that the women could bring their kids in, and we provided food for everyone and compensated them for their time and for coming all the way to the city corporation where we hosted the meetings. When they heard about all of this and when they saw their neighbors growing these trees, they started calling me and they started calling us. And now we have a huge pressure of like, okay, when are we going to go back? When are we going to plant it? When are we going to do it? And I'm like, okay, just hold on. I need, you know, so we have now started our survey for scaling up the project. And also what has this also done, when we went in to these communities initially, so we didn't immediately go in and was like, oh, we're here to plant trees. We started having conversations, right? Like, and what we realized that, yes, even though urban greening is something that was universally acknowledged, that, yeah, it would be nice to have some trees here, but do you know that there's this other pressing thing that we have been asking the city to deal with for millions of years, and it has remained unaddressed? So a lot of those things, and as I said, heat affects every level of governance or each and every urban system that there exists in Dhaka City. So we found that there were a lot of problems that they were already living with. Like, for example, waste that was not being collected, that was just creating hotspots within their, right next to their houses. We found the children going from point A to point B just to go to school, they would like have to walk over 30 minutes. Whereas they could have just, if there was a bridge or like a safer way to cross the road, then they could minimize that heat exposure and get to school within 10 to 15 minutes. We found these problems. And again, I'm the chief heat officer, right? I don't have that jurisdiction to fix roads or...
More's the pity.
But if I linked them to heat, what I was able to do is link these issues to heat, which was very easy to do because, as I said, everything is connected.
I want to just bring in our audience members. I'll present my mic across. So if you'll introduce yourself. Did you want to ask a question?
Good to be here. My name is Onyedi. I live in Dubai. Work at the Expo as well. I'm from Nigeria. There is one chief heat officer in Asia. You're the first. And I think there is one chief heat officer in Africa. I think so. She's from, yeah, from Sierra Leone, Freetown. Exactly.
I love the way you're all on first name terms.
So just two. But I think that means that number is going to grow. And I think one of the things you've been talking about that I've taken quite a good note of is the connectivity of the issues around heat. But I also think that kind of means all the shoulders you kind of have to brush, you know, like to get something done. And so as this role grows, how do you see that, you know, that role of the chief heat officer evolving? If you look at it from a place of like even budget lines, for example, like you've spoken a lot about the, like, you know, community engagement, but what about governance as well? Like,
oh my God.
And how do you see that evolving? Like, even from a place of legislation as well, like what's the mandate, you know, and how do you see that mandate expanding?
You have hit the nail. Is that the expression? What's the expression?
The nail on the head.
Sorry, I'm still Bengali at the end of the day.
Hit that nail on the head.
So yes, we have to brush shoulders with people. It's something that I actively look forward to, just because without the buy-in of different governing authorities and different government stakeholders, you are not getting anywhere. Then you might as well just work, like you're not going to get any policy level change or impacts. Like if you want to make bigger impacts, you have to work with different, for example, I'll give you, so recently we started looking at early warning systems. We are still, I hate to say this and I hate that it's true, but we are still very much operating in post-colonial times where our Met Office is under the Ministry of Defense. And our Department of Disaster Management is under another ministry. And our Health Department is under another ministry. So this type of isolation, it really prevents people from able to share information. And that gridlocks you into just doing the same thing over and over again without being able to extend yourself or without being able to work with people from different places and to make a real impact, especially a positive impact on public health. For example, if there's flooding that's going to happen in a few days, our Met Office can't really say there's going to be a flood. They are only allowed to say that there will be excess rainfall up to like maybe 5 millimeters or something. They're not allowed to say that word, because if they do, they'll get a call, be like, hey, why are you saying that word? That word is ours, you know? So nobody wants to step on anyone's toes. No one wants to get audited. So we're still stuck in these rudimentary systems, which I feel like it's so rudimentary. We need to go beyond this. We need to transcend these systems, these outdated systems, and work together, share data, share information, because at the end of the day, it will positively affect public health. In fact, when the city is not actively involved in these conversations, then it's not resilient. It's not sustainable for the city to literally find themselves one day in a heat wave and have no idea what to do. So altogether with the health department and disaster management department and the Met Office, they all need to work together. They need to work with the volunteers like the Red Crescent Society. You know, everyone needs to work together to prepare a plan to force not just forecasting, but distribute that information, and for the city to be able to create solutions and spread awareness about those solutions and guidelines. And regarding what you said about the cooling zones as well, like it is so interesting that when you said that, because we are also trying to see what are the spaces that are in our city that are just wasted or that are just abandoned or that are just full of trash, or, you know, men sitting in their lungis and, you know, smoking, man spreading, because that's a very common sight when you look at countries in our cities. It's funny, but it's so real. Like if you've ever been in Dhaka or if you've been in a city in India, like you know what I'm talking about. But we want to change that, because women in my city especially, they don't feel safe to take space in public. And I want to change that. I want to change that so that they feel welcome, that they feel cooler, the children feel safer. I feel like I really want to get to know you more, because if we could combine that concept with your artistic concept, that would be amazing.
Bushra Afrian talking about the power of collaboration and the pursuit of real-world fixes that can drive meaningful change at pace and scale for people across the Global South who are most in need and facing the greatest jeopardy from the ongoing climate crisis. Exactly the kind of proactivity, positivity and commitment that underscores so much of the discourse at the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum in Expo City Dubai this month. As well as Bushra, we heard from Monocle's Andrew Tuck, of course, and also from Antonia Carver of Art Jameel. My thanks to them all, to our producer and editor Sam Impey, and to all the Forum and Expo City team. Do stay tuned for our final special episode from the Forum coming up soon, right here on The Briefing on Monocle Radio. But that's all for now. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.